Good evening. My name is Shane Chebsey, and this is The Icecast. On The Icecast, we talk to comic artists, writers, and publishers about their work, their lives, and everything in between. And this evening on The Icecast, I'm very happy to welcome Paul Rainey. Good evening, Paul. How you doing, mate?
Hello, Shane. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure, mate. It's been a while since we've had a chat. Yeah. So when I saw that you'd won the, Observer Jonathan Cape Comicographic Prize. God, that's a mouthful, isn't it?
It's not even all the words. You missed some of the words out.
Oh, God.
You missed a short story bit out.
Oh, yeah, a short story, but a very long title.
I was going to ask, how long does this go on for? And then you started reading the title of the competition out. I went, oh, no, I'm not going to get any tea tonight, am I? It's going to go on forever.
We'll keep it nice and short, mate. We'll keep it
nice. Do you remember The Mighty World of Marvel? It was called The Mighty World of Marvel, featuring the Incredible Hulk.
Oh, yes.
And Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. And that still feels shorter than the title to the short story prize.
It does indeed. It does indeed. But when I read it, I thought, it's long overdue I spoke to Paul.
Yeah.
But congratulations, mate.
Thank you.
As I said in our sort of online, you know, long overdue recognition of your work. Yeah, you know, I've always been a massive fan since the first encounter I had. I think it's going back a little bit now, but I think it was Memory Man.
Yes, that was '90s, wasn't it? Yeah. Because I remember the first time I met you was at Caption, and you had a table there. So
that's right.
I may have been hawking Memory Man then, which would have been the '90s.
Yeah, we're talking mid to late 90s.
Mid-late 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that wasn't your first foray into publishing your own comics, was it, Paul?
No, I helped friends. So friends of mine did a zine. Well, we called it a magazine. We were trying to disassociate ourselves from zines, even though it was photocopied, called The Spot, which was a Milton Keynes sort of arts music mainly about local bands. Right.
Yeah.
And I was the comic editor, which meant I just did
the comics.
And then some other people would contribute as well. But, well, I didn't meet any of them. They would just post them in from other parts of Milton Keynes. And then I think Memory Man was my first proper, you know,
like a long
foray
form
into it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did stuff. I did something called Clone magazine when I was about 14.
Wow.
With my friend Robert Patrick, which was, I don't have copies anymore, but I remember drawing Electra Assassin, and she was about 7 foot tall. She was just far too tall.
Well, that's obviously how you saw her.
Yeah.
You know, when you,
yeah.
At 14 years old, she was larger than life.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So you were, you were a Marvel fan then, I assume, as a young kid?
Yeah, a very young kid. Yeah, when I first got into comics, I was about 7. Yeah, it's definitely Marvel stuff for the first few years until the 80s. I'm that age where I've been into comics for a long time before the 1980s even started. So I started off with Marvel stuff, UK stuff.
Mighty World of Marvel, yeah. And The Mighty World of Marvel featuring the Incredible Hulk and Nick Fury and his Howling Commandos.
Yeah.
Great title.
It was one like, featuring the Incredible Hulk and where man once stood supreme, now rule the apes, planet of the apes.
That's another one.
They even put the tagline.
That's enough. But they were great strips, weren't they, Planet of the Apes? I spoke about those with other guests I've had on here. I think,
funny enough, it's funny you should mention that. I bought sorry, I interrupted you.
Okay.
I bought IDW, I think it was, or Boom, did a hardback collection of I love my eBay success stories. So I bought a hardback collection of volume 1 for £25.
Wow.
Which was apparently quite a good deal. And then about a couple of months later, it was selling on eBay for £100.
Ooh.
So I went, sell it. It's not why I bought it, but I got carried away. Then this is like when you buy a pin and you swap it for a paperclip and you swap it for something, you know.
Yeah.
So then used that £100 and I bought every issue of Marvel UK's Planet of the Apes comics.
Oh.
And I read them all. And I went, yeah, they're all right. They weren't quite... The Planet of the Apes stories were brilliant. Because that's the... But I didn't really feel that I wanted that big pile It wasn't a lot of books. Gold.
It's a lot of books.
It's a lot of comics. Yeah. So I sold those for about 180 quid, making a nice tidy profit.
Wow.
I don't know what I used that for. Anyway, eventually I bought a house.
You did all right then.
Yeah.
And now you're into the property market. Well, that's even better, isn't it? They just go up even more.
Yeah. Now I'm funding the Conservatives. Now I'm doing PPE for the National Health NHS.
Of course, that's the thing as well. You're one of these artists, aren't you, that's been around a long time. You've been doing amazing work, but you've never been able to sort of go full time into comics, have you?
I don't know how to do it. I don't get how people are successful with publishers. I don't understand it. And maybe they don't. They're just more persistent, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
But, I don't get that. I would love to get it.
Well, maybe, there's still time. There's still time for that to change.
I think maybe, hopefully this win equips me to approach publishers with my stuff and say, I won this competition.
Yeah, look what I did.
You need to look at what I'm sending you with greater consideration.
Yeah. I'm important. Publish my stuff.
Yeah. Six people thought I was the best.
And they're all gonna be buying your stuff.
Yeah.
But I think it has amazed me though, Paul, to be honest, that you haven't become some sort of superstar, because when I read your books and when I in your comic strips, I'm always astonished at how consistently good they are. And how you you're welcome. And I've always noticed that you have a very clear concept behind all the work that you do. It always seems to me, like most really great artists out there, you've got something to say. You're not just making comics to make comics. It always feels like you've got a story to tell. It might just be a simple story, like this story that's just won this prize, a chance meeting in a pub, which, and I've read it, by the way, and it's great. I love your signature mannerisms and your signature dialogue. It's all there. But I'm not going to stop blowing smoke up your ass. But
no, I love it.
Yeah. But when you create, would you say that was right? When you make a comic, do you have something other than the desire just to make comics? Is this like desire there to tell these stories, to get these moments out there and to share them?
I have a desire to, I think I've always wanted to do something lasting and meaningful. And I think the things that I've read that have been lasting and meaningful have been more than just what they appear to be on the surface, in my view.
Yeah.
So, I mean, an obvious example might be Watchmen. It's not just a superhero story. So I like to kind of give it be more than just what it seems on the surface. And to, if I do a long form thing, like There's No Time Like the Present or Why Don't You Love Me, I'd like the people reading it, part of the experience of reading it is working out actually what it's about. Do you know what I mean? And hopefully you won't finish it going, oh, I don't know what that was about. Hopefully there'll be a moment of where the penny drops.
Yeah.
But so I like doing that sort of thing. I really work hard on the writing of stuff because, I think when I was younger, I was always told I wasn't as good at writing as I wanted to be. So I've always tried very hard at the writing. And and I always, but more recently, in recent years, I've gone, I need to also focus on the artwork a bit more.
That's the thing, is it, when you're doing both? Yeah. It's like, I think most strip artists who do both have these periods where they have to concentrate on one more than the other because they feel that, I've just sort of maybe got into a rut with how I write or got into a rut with how I draw. And I think when you're comfortable in a style and you can maybe, not churn it out, but produce the work to a satisfactory level without too much effort, there's a temptation perhaps to just like go into that flow and concentrate on something else. So I suppose it makes sense that sometimes you need to go from one to the other just to keep yourself on your toes,
But I think if you do like a new project, I don't know how you are, but I'll try and find a different way of working. It might not be obvious to people who read it, but from my perspective, I'll go, right, I'm going to write it this way, and then I'm going to draw it this way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so that way you're kind of triggering your own excitement about it. And
You don't want to rest on your laurels, do you? As you know, when you're creating new work,
no, you want to feel that you're constantly improving, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. Because I mean, like most creators, you know, I know I'm like this. Is I instantly dislike things when I finish them, you know, and I need to move on to the next thing, so I feel better about the work.
I'm all right. I kind of do still like stuff.
That's, you know, good.
I still like Scene and what was it, Similar to but Not, or what's called Showbiz.
I like it that much I've forgotten the title.
Yeah, I still like it. So and I finished that a couple of months ago. I submitted it in well in advance of the deadline because you couldn't tell what's going to happen with COVID. I went, I'm just going to submit it straight away, get it done. So I still like that. I still like Why Don't You Love Me. And then there's stuff I might kind of not look at because I'm afraid.
You're afraid that you might see things you don't like.
Yeah. I mean, after a period of time, there's a point where you go, oh God, what was I thinking? You know, but it's usually art in my case.
Yeah. It's so easy, isn't it, to see the faults in your own work. I think, I mean, going back to There's No Time Like the Present, which you mentioned before, for me, that was one of those moments where you sort of took a leap, you know, from one type of storytelling to another. Not just in the style of the storytelling, but in the way that you constructed the whole series. I mean, it was quite a big series and it was quite a big vision. When you started, did you know what the end was going to be? Did you always have it, the whole thing in place? Or did you sort of discover it as you went along to a certain extent?
No, I knew what the end was going to be. But I knew it would take me, it took me, I think I add more years to it every time I say this, but I think it took me about 7 or 8 years to finish. It was like, no, it can't be that long.
It's not far
off.
It
might be 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
But like, I knew how it was going to end. But what I did was I didn't fill out the detail. I left loads of space in it. I saw it as a journey that had to kind of make all these stop-offs before it got to its destination.
Yeah.
And so I would write a scene at a time and I'd go, all right, this is the first part of the journey we need to go to here and we need to establish this, this and this. So, but that's kind of how I did it because I knew that, because it would take me a long time because I had a day job then. I didn't want to get bored with it. And I was determined to see it through to the end.
Right.
So, yeah, but I always knew how that ended. Whereas Why Don't You Love Me, which I'm doing now, I've only just worked out the end and I'm about 10 pages from finishing it. And it's going to work out well, but I didn't have a destination. I knew at that point was it was going to be 210 pages.
Wow. So how do you map out something like that when it's that long and you haven't got the end? How do you sort of plan how it's going to come out and how the issues are going to work? Do you work out the chapters, like rough chapters? So it's like this chapter, all these things are going to happen. This chapter, all these things are going to happen. Is it sort of mapped out in a rough way like that?
Well, with There's No Time at the Present, I it's not really chaptered, although it does have breaks in it.
Yeah.
But
because it's quite a complicated timeline, isn't it? Because you've got all those the different parts of the story happening at different times. And I mean, I remember reading it and yeah, thinking, where what's happening? It wasn't. It kept me on my toes.
You got to the end, and you kind of, I get what's happening.
Yeah, it's worth it. You know, it's a good payoff. It's a good investment of your time.
It.
Yeah,
I think it's got to have one. You've got to enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
If you don't enjoy it, then you know why stick around. But you've got to have a good end, I think. Otherwise it's, you know, what's the point? I know some writers or people say, oh, it's about the journey, and it is about the journey, but I want a good end.
You've got to feel like you've invested all this time in something, and then poof, if the ending isn't satisfactory, you've lost, you know, the people just lose faith then, don't they? And you feel that you haven't delivered. I mean, the classic example is the bloody Lost TV series, you know. What was it, 7 seasons or something ridiculous
that? Apparently.
And then a complete cop-out ending.
Apparently, I only watched 4 episodes and then I messed up the video recording of it, of episode 5. And I kind of knew then that, I kind of suspected then that they didn't know where they were going.
Yeah.
But I've subsequently seen The Leftovers and Watchmen, Don't Tell Alan Moore. Yeah. And they were great shows, absolutely brilliant. And I've actually been tempted to go and visit Lost.
Yeah.
But with the knowledge that the ending is going to be disappointing to stop after 3 seasons.
Maybe that's because that's the good times, isn't it? Apparently. I haven't gone for Watchmen TV series yet. Mostly because, I mean, did you really enjoy it? Did you think it was a good show?
Yeah, I watched it skeptically.
Yeah.
Initially, and then
I just can't bring myself.
Oh, this is good.
Wow. So I've heard so many mixed opinions of it. I just can't bring myself to watch it.
Is there a moral thing for you?
Maybe, yeah. I don't know. Because I watched the movie, but I don't know.
I thought the movie was awful.
Yeah.
I don't like the movie at all.
There's bits I like. I mean, I think when it's close to the book, it's good. When every time it veers away from the book, it's bad. You know, and it's also...
So they had that opening sequence where they had this really good bit of storytelling.
The montage, that was lovely.
This looks promising. Mm. Although I don't really rate that director particularly.
Right.
Zack Snyder. I enjoy... I'll tell you in a minute. I'm going off topic, but...
That's all right.
Then they had that scene where they're having a fight with the comedian in the apartment.
Yes.
And Ozymandias, it's supposed to be, isn't he?
Yeah.
Isn't it? But we don't know who he is at that point.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
He's punching chunks out of the wall.
Mm.
And I'm going...
They both are, aren't they? They
don't get what the book is about. You immediately confused your audience.
Yeah, yeah.
Surely.
Yeah.
But the TV show at least gets all of that.
Right.
And I think morally, it's okay to watch it because Dave Gibbons... was involved. I don't know if you're aware, also did Watchmen.
Yes, yeah.
And I mean, surely, if one artist is okay with it, you can at least morally justify it.
Well, that's how I justified watching the movie originally. And I remember we did a little Q&A with Dave because we...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when I was doing Bix, which I'm sure you'll remember because you used to visit
this show.
We did a Watchmen Q&A where we had it on the IMAX screen. Dave came and did a talk and an introduction to the film. And it was actually a great little event. And it felt like, well, Dave's full on with it, you know. So I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, what are your feelings? I was getting around to a question. What are your feelings? You know, because I often look at your stuff and I think there's such potential here for it to be an animation. Because your style is so well conceived and your voice and your dialogue is so good, I think it would work really well in animation. How would you feel about that as a creator? Would you have any problems with that? Do you feel that your stuff, you know, is just for comics, or do you feel that it could be adapted?
I don't have a problem with it, but it's not an objective. But I like thinking about people who don't read comics, you think of as not reading comics normally, as possibly enjoying it. As if I have to think about an audience, I'm thinking, I guess, more about as much about that as people who buy comics, I guess, if not more so.
Mm.
And I kind of imagine my comics as being a really good TV show, but I think my idea of a good TV show isn't shaped by modern TV. I think it's like, you know, like when you used to find a really good comedy on BBC Two at 9:30 on a Monday night.
But no one else seems to watch. Yeah.
And then a year later, everybody's really into it.
Mm.
That's kind of, I guess that's what I'm thinking of partly when I do stuff. But it's when I did Memory Man, I wasn't thinking, oh, it'd be great. I was partly, but it wasn't an objective. The objective was a really good comic.
Yeah.
But I did imagine it being like a TV show as well.
And I don't think there's any harm in that, is there? Because comics are a storytelling medium, aren't they? And so's TV, so's film. And I think for a lot of people who create, it's all about telling stories. And it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily have to be in the form of comics. I mean, we're both massive comics fans. And I think that comics is always going to be our first choice.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't think there's any harm in looking at I hate the word property.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even saying it.
I don't think like that. I think there's a difference between like daydreaming and then kind of what happens in comics now, where you have people seemingly or clearly thinking in those terms.
Yeah, actively pursuing it.
Yeah. And I don't mean knocking on doors even. You can see it in what you're reading, and there's too much of that. And the comics need to kind of go, you know, we need to push against that as a thing and make comics that purposefully obstruct that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So that's kind of... So when I say I imagine it as a TV show, I imagine it as a TV show that's impossible to make, maybe. Or, do you know what I mean? I think of it as my kind of TV show that couldn't possibly ever happen.
That's playing in your head, basically.
Yeah, it's technically impossible. I don't, you know, but the idea that you focus on that as your ultimate objective is... really bad for the art form that we...
Yeah, I agree. Because I think what you're doing then, you're limiting the comic, aren't you? You're limiting it within the parameters of what could be shown on a screen, and you're not taking full advantage of what I call the magic of comics.
Yeah, but you're also... You're being insulting to the art form. You're saying it's part of the process of making a TV show. Mm. It absolutely isn't. Or a film. It absolutely isn't. It's a... Yeah. It's an art form in its own right.
Definitely, definitely. I'm well with you there.
Yeah, brother.
Yeah, solidarity. Yeah. So one of the little things we do on this, when I get the chance to, is when I can see a bookshelf in the background, I ask the guests to pick a book that they feel is something that influenced them from their bookshelf and tell me a little story about that's a total lie. I've never been that constructive about that question, but I've just decided it's a really good way of doing it.
Right, I'm just looking now. I've got to choose one.
Choose one that says this is something is important to me.
I'm just going to have to take my headphones off.
That's all right.
I can point at it. I'll just say Fantastic Four Omnibus One.
Okay.
Your listeners are just hearing this.
And I totally trust that it's there.
Can you not see it? Yeah.
Is that the big red one?
No, I'm obstructing the camera.
I can see your hand now. I assume it's the big red one.
It's definitely up there. It's second shelf. Anyway, it's got all the first 30 issues of the Fantastic Four by Kirby. Wow. And we were talking about Marvel UK earlier. Do you remember the complete Fantastic Four comic?
I do. Well, I had, like, my cousin had it. He's a bit older than me because it was in mid-70s, wasn't it? And I didn't really discover it until, you know, early 80s, like 79, 80. And my cousin had them. He just gave me loads of his old comics. I know. I've got a load. Complete Fantastic Four, the Avengers reprints, Mighty World and Marvel, Planet of the Apes, Dracula Lives.
Yeah.
Gold, pure gold, you know.
Yeah.
I've still got them. That was special to you then, that initial run being Kirby?
You remember Complete Fantastic Four would have like a more recent Fantastic Four full issue of that at the beginning, and then the backup were reprints of the Lee Kirby stuff.
Yes.
Again, it's all reprints, but reprints.
Yeah.
And I just remember going, these strips at the back are just brilliant. I much preferred them.
Yeah.
It's just so exotic. And then I think at a jumble sale, I found a bunch of like the first year or two of The Mighty World of Marvel.
Mm.
And that had loads of war strips from that era that I love so much.
I mean, you had the Ditko Spider-Man. The Wallywood Daredevils were in some of them as well.
That's right.
And obviously, you know, the classic Hulk stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a period. And to get all of those strips into one sort of anthology. I mean,
Could you imagine being
so lucky,
8 years
really.
Old and picking up the Mighty World of Marvel number one, and you got like Kirby's Hulk, Ditko's Spider-Man, and Kirby's Fantastic Four.
We were spoiled. We were spoiled, weren't we? You know, I mean, it doesn't get. And the other thing I loved about it, I don't know how you feel about this. They were in black and white.
Well, the dead early ones had a colour, didn't they? So they had some colour.
It was like monotone, wasn't it? Like green or like orange. Green.
It was like a second colour.
Yeah.
But it really suited it, I think.
Yeah, Hulk was always green and Spider-Man was always like off red, wasn't he?
Yeah. And then they abandoned that after about a year, it seems.
Yeah.
And then they added a sort of horrible grey tone that just kind of muted to this black. Oh. So you kind of get all these silhouetted characters. You go, what's going on here?
Yeah, I don't know what they were thinking there. But when they got it right, when the reproduction was just black and white, it looked lovely. It really did. And
well, it did take them a while, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what they were doing for that period.
I think they were doing it from photocopies. 1974 photocopy technology.
Yeah.
I mean, you lost all the line and...
Yeah, I always wondered how they managed to reproduce stuff back then, because it must have been hard work to make it look good, because it was on newsprint as well, and they used to fall apart, didn't they, though, those books?
Yeah.
And when you started producing your early comics, did you think about things like that, sort of how they would be, because you were self-publishing, so what sort of challenges did you face? You know, when you were trying to like produce your own books, because back then we didn't have the internet, we didn't have the printing access that we do now. There's no such thing as digital print. You couldn't do digital comics. Your coloring stuff was, and to print color stuff, you know, it just wasn't possible, was it?
No, when they did Memory Man, I got I did one issue. The first issue was 200. And I think I put that together from photocopies, but I didn't photocopy it. I went to a printer.
Right.
But it may as well have been photocopied because it was from photocopies.
Yeah.
Which is how I worked. Yeah. I didn't kind of process that there should have been a more better way of doing it.
Right.
And then I sent that to my Diamond UK, and someone there said, oh, I really like this, which was nice to hear.
Yeah.
But you should try and get Diamond US to distribute it.
Sure.
So they didn't like it, but they liked, by that point I'd finished the second story, and they said, oh, we like this, so they distributed it. So I've got two number ones on Memory Man. And I remember between them soliciting it and me getting the orders through, I was convinced that I was the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I was in my job and I was going, I just need to sell 5,000 of each issue and I could leave this job. I'd be no problem. And I got orders for 179 or something. I was really devastated.
Oh, it's horrible, that feeling, isn't it?
You had to get 500 done at least for the unit price to be reasonable.
Yeah.
And I was just pissing money up the wall. It was so depressing. And of course, being the comic industry, issue two's orders were like 120. And then issue three, it's just...
goes down,
ever diminishing.
I
used the same printer as I think Paul Grist's Kane.
Right.
I looked through an issue of Kane and I went, oh, they use Oakley Press, I think they were called.
Oh, I remember that. I've got some issues of Kane, actually. It was a good book, that was.
It's brilliant. I was looking through them the other day, actually. That was a good comic.
Paul Grist doesn't do enough stuff. I'd buy everything he puts out.
Well, he's doing that. Is he doing a comic for Marvel at the moment?
He is, but he's not. He's just writing covers, isn't he? He's not doing the interiors, I don't think.
I think he's doing ad hoc interiors.
Yeah. He said
flashbacks or something.
I said to him, I said, I want you to be doing all the interiors because then I'll buy it. And he said, Marvel won't let me do all the interiors.
Fucking idiots.
There's something the matter with those people. But there you go. So anyway, where were we, mate? Sorry, we went off track again.
So then I went, I'm going to scrap Memory Man and I'll do a new comic set within the same world called Love Bomb, which is like an anthology.
I remember that.
And I thought I'd learnt a strategy now. I'd send the advanced copies out to all the indie friendly. Do you remember a magazine called Indie? It's an American comics magazine that favoured, I don't know if it lasted very long, but they ran
I don't think they would run a
list of shops in the back,
right,
that were independent friendly. Oh. So I sent all those shops an advanced issue of Love and Rock, Love Bomb. Sorry, not Love and Rock.
Taking credit for something else.
Yeah. Yeah. Oops.
You'd be doing all right now.
It's fixing out Jaime Hernandez's name and putting Paul Rainey. And I went, I thought, I've got experience now. And then it got solicited and I got orders for 220 or something. Ooh, I went,
It's better.
It worked, yeah. But it's cost me a bloody fortune. And then, of course, orders issue two just went like that.
Yeah.
And I finished drawing issue three and then Diamond went, no, we don't want to carry your stuff anymore.
Disheartening, isn't it?
I was devastated because at those days, I couldn't think how you got your stuff out to people.
You know, well, that's it. That's what I was saying. Yeah, there was no internet. Well, there was an internet.
It was very formative, but people weren't really doing comics on it.
No.
It would take 2 hours to load a page. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It just wasn't practical, was it? It
wasn't practical.
No. And there was no print on demand either. So you couldn't sort of... I mean, how self-publishers can do it now... There's just that flexibility, isn't there? You've got print on demand. Yeah. You've got the internet. There's loads of ways that you can reach out to a fan base. So you can. You don't even need a publisher anymore. You know, you can just, or a distributor. You can just reach out. You can build a fan base and reach out.
It's so much better in that regard because it's so archaic and monopolistic.
Yeah.
You know, is that a word?
It is now.
In the '90s. Yeah, well, I've decided it is.
Yeah.
In, you know, at that time, I just felt that I was never going to get anywhere. But it was partly my own hubris because, you know, going through Diamond, there was a vibrant small press scene that where people were photocopying their own stuff and, you know, doing really exciting things with their comics that I was forced to engage with. Do you know what I mean? I didn't think I was above it. You just wanted to do a good job.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, when you look at everyone else and what they're doing, when you're doing self-publishing, you always look at those guys and you think, okay, well, this is the scene as it is. Can I do better? I don't think that's a bad thing to do. I think it's good to have ambition and to put yourself up against your contemporaries and think, can I do better than that? You know,
I did a strip called Book of Lists, and that was an internet strip.
Yes.
And then when I got enough together, I then photocopied a comic.
Yeah,
and I did the cover on pink paper.
I remember. I still got copies, actually.
Have you?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So I remember I got like 20 or 30 done. I can't remember. Not loads. Mm. And I went to, it may have been Caption, and I sold out. And I went, huh? I was really, you know, I'd been going to Caption all through the 90s, every other year from the beginning. And then I started going every year around the year 2000.
Mm.
And I thought, my stuff is getting a better response.
Mm.
And it's photocopied at Staples. Mm. And all I've done is spray mounted the colour logo on the cover.
Yeah, there's like that handmade thing as well. People love things that have got a little bit of a handmade approach to them, don't they?
People responded really well to that aesthetic. Mm. And it was, it's like when Darius came back to the X Factor after his humiliating rejection on Pop Idol.
I'm trying to think of how you're going to make that work. how does that compare to Darius from Pop Idol? You lost me. Your logic's lost on me there, Paul, I have to say.
Yeah.
You have to explain
He got rejected, didn't he, from Pop Idol?
I get you.
And then he came back, or you were dodging for X Factor a couple of years later.
Yes,
he came third or something.
And he did all right, yeah. So basically what you're saying is you'd found an audience that appreciated your work.
Yeah, definitely. And a network of people who were supportive of each other and...
Mm, mm.
Interested in each other's work and
I mean Caption was an amazing thing. I don't think it happens anymore, does it? Caption.
No, it stopped.
Yeah,
I wanted nothing more than to be a guest at Caption, and then eventually I got asked to be a guest. I went every year. I was like a regular face.
Yeah.
And eventually I got asked to be a guest, but it was the first Caption that wasn't in Oxford. It was in Coventry.
Yeah.
And then obviously being a guest, I was going to get an interview. And I went, oh, great, I'm going to get an interview. It was the only event that was running concurrently with another event.
Oh.
Caption. So there were three people there.
Oh, no. And,
two of them were my friends, Jay and Selena.
Oh,
and one
bless
was
him.
Some poor bastard who couldn't leave because he knew he didn't notice.
Oh,
and then,
God.
It was like all these things. I broke it. There was never been a caption since. I would be
kiss of death.
There's no graphic short story competition next year.
I'm getting worried now. I'm worried. Is this going to be the last ever ice cast?
Yeah, that's it.
The curse of Paul Rainey. I can see that could be the new comic.
These were, you know, Orbital comic shop.
Yes.
Talking about, I am like the kiss of death. So I was like, do you remember Page 45 used to do Independence Day every year? They'd have these big Independence stars, and they usually have a big international star, like Dave Sim, for example.
Yeah.
In 96, I was one of the people at guests at Independence Day, and I was so pleased.
Yeah.
Never fucking done one since. Caption. Never done one since. When Orbital Comics used to do a podcast, so they would like do like a little interview in the shop.
And I remember
record
that.
It, yeah, and they'd release it as a podcast. Mine was never released as a podcast. I've gone, what's going
what
on?
What are you doing? It really is the kiss of death, isn't it?
There's No Time Like the Present is the last book Escape Books has ever published.
It just goes on and on. Well,
when I was doing the interview for the Observer article.
Yeah. Did you warn them? Did you tell
them? I felt a pain in my chest.
Damn,
it's going to happen.
I'm going to kill the newspaper.
Yeah. It's going to announce it's going out of business.
Oh, dear. So when... we'll talk about that then as we're on it. How did it feel to win the prize, Paul? How did you find out? Did you find out quite a while before?
I got an email about 2 weeks before.
Mm.
And then I had my drawing board up and I was going to draw.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get a page penciled. And then I spent all that time phoning people. I'm only going to phone three people. My mate, Robert Wells, who I moan to every year about the competition when I didn't win. Because I've entered 12 times.
Oh, have you?
It's the 12th time that I won.
Oh, well done. Perseverance and all that.
Well, yeah. And then I phoned my mum.
Oh.
And I phoned my friend Mick, who we'd be going out on these socially distanced walks together.
Right.
And I'd been talking about rattling. So it seemed fair that I'd tell these people. And then I was going to get on with drawing. And I went, oh, I've got to phone my friend to proofread it. And I've got a phone. And then I've got to let. And then before I knew it, it was about 10:30. And I got the email about 2:30 in the afternoon.
Oh, God.
So you can't tell anybody. I'm fine.
You just told off the country,
Well, I'm allowed to tell. You're allowed to, but
yeah,
you couldn't. But they couldn't put it online because I think. I mean, I wasn't really told, but they wanted to announce it.
Yeah.
You know, I still can't process that it happened, really.
Mm.
I don't really know what it means. Once the money's in my bank account, I'll go, oh, I think it's real.
I get it now.
Yeah, it's definitely real.
You want to buy something that you can then sell on. And
that's it. Yeah. I might buy some more collections of Planet of the Apes.
That's it. Guaranteed money maker, Planet of the Apes comics. I
invest that money in Apple.
Yeah. Or is it Amazon? Or Amazon. Yeah. Yeah, they seem to be the ones that are going up nowadays, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was brilliant. Yeah. I mean, It's the implication of what it may mean as well, isn't it? Because the previous winners have, many of them have had graphic novels published. And also, when you self-publish, and most of your stuff is self-published, you don't really know if you're any good. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
People buy your stuff, you think they're just being nice. Mm. You don't really believe it. And then this happened.
Yeah.
It's not in their interest to be nice. They want the best entry to be the winner. And it's the first time I came away going, I might be all right. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Because you don't get it, do you? You don't get feedback. You don't, you know, that one of the things about self-publishing, it was, you know, like yourself, I haven't done it quite as long as you, but I wasn't long after. I think 94 I started. And it is really hard to get anyone to give you honest feedback, good or bad. And it's really hard to get any sort of recognition if you're into that sort of thing. And so when something like this happens, like you say, it's not just like some fake validation. It's a genuine thing because they've chosen your strip out of lots of other strips. It's not like when you're at a convention and you say, will you buy my comic? And then they buy it because they're scared that you'll badger them.
Yeah.
They've actually chosen it. And that's a good thing.
We've done conventions. You sit at a convention and you watch people file past.
Mm.
Hours at a time, hours and yeah, hours.
Yeah.
And you eventually, I've shared tables with friends and they know what I'm like before I sell anything. It's the worst for them. I'm just terrible. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I'll sell my first item and I'm the happiest person. I'm like the extremes of emotions at these things.
Yeah.
And I've seen people kind of walk down the small press tables. And they kind of do a big horseshoe arc around my table. And you're going, mate, come on. At least I could see the need in my eyes, maybe.
I think maybe that's what it is, you know.
So it's all those memories of those things.
And they do wear you down, don't they? If you do, I know I'm myself selling stuff at cons. If you do two or three cons where you don't do very well, for one reason or another, when it seems like there's, you know, a force field around your table and people can't get through it, you know, we've all been there. And you do two or three of them and you do start to have a lot of self-doubt, don't you? Because you're just thinking, well, is this any good? This stuff that we're putting
in? I think there may be people that do cons because they see it's a social event. They go there and they meet their friends and they don't really mind that they've not broken even or they're down. Do you know what I mean? Or or even that they haven't sold as much as maybe I have even. Do you know what I mean? Doesn't bother them in that way. But I want people to buy my stuff. I want to earn a living out of it. And I'm not greedy.
No.
And I've learned from doing this for years and years and years, it's not going to happen by me sitting behind a table at a comic convention because I've done that constantly.
You've done it long enough.
And there have been a couple of occasions when I've gone, oh, I'm not doing these things anymore. And I've taken long breaks.
Mm.
And then I thought I found a way to kind of at least enjoy it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
So I took a couple of years between Thunder Brother and Pope Francis. And I thought, well, I found a printer near to me and he'll do just 20 copies if I want just 20 copies.
That's good.
And he'll do a really good job. And that made a big difference to me being able to engage in conventions. And I got a real beer in my bonnet maybe last year where I went, I should be a fucking guest. Why am I paying to exhibit? You see, some of these people who are guests, why are they guests and I'm not a guest? Now, it sounds arrogant. Mm. I'm going, I've been doing this for like 30 years.
You've done your time, haven't you? You've done your time.
I'm occasionally in Viz, and that must be read by... I'm going to make a figure up. 60,000 people.
I would guess that's not far off.
There aren't many comics these days that sell that many.
No.
Why am I paying to... Why am I having to go buy my own bottled water?
Well, now...
Well, that arsehole over there is getting it bought to him.
Well, now you can demand, can't you?
He's got a chicken dinner.
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, being an organiser, I've had this conversation with a lot of artists, and it's part of the reason we started doing the ICE Indie Spotlight, because I wanted to have indie people as guests to say, you know, these guys work just as hard, these guys are just as good, you know. And obviously, it's that balancing act.
You're saying you're always really good. I was always honest with my feedback to you. And you always took it very well. I mean, hopefully I was never rude. But no. I don't think it achieves anything by kind of saying, oh no, I've had a really great day.
It hasn't been what
I'd hoped it to be.
Mm.
And I think I've done enough to have a realistic expectation of these things.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think now you can say, can't you? You've won this prize. You can say, I should be a guest. You can demand. And you want blue Skittles in a bowl. I mean, there's people who have not put the hours and the time in that you have who consider themselves, you know, you wouldn't believe some of the people, I'm not going to name names for obvious reasons, but some of the people who contact me and say, can I be a guest at your show? First of all, I always think, well, a guest is someone who's invited. You don't invite yourself.
Yeah.
The other thing is, you know, well, what have you done? You know, and how can I justify the expenditure of paying for your hotel and your travel? How many people are you going to bring through the door? That's, you know, that's a realistic. And you always have to balance that up, you know, with, okay, I really like this person's work. I want to support them. I want to give them a platform. But at the same time, we need to make sure there's enough people coming through the door. So, and you can only afford so many guests. So it is a balancing act. But I think it's interesting. Go on, mate.
I forget that you, just in conversation, I kind of forgot in a way that you, but of course, I think conventions need to change.
Mm.
I don't think it serves, does it really help comics for people to go to a marquee or a hall and they see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of self-publishers sitting behind tables, desperate to sell their... do you know what I mean?
Is
it good for either side in that relation, that customer and...
Yeah, I think there must be some positives to it. When you look at stuff like Thought Bubble, when you've got like literally hundreds of tables, that's
really what I was thinking of.
Yeah, I mean, it does sustain. It seems to be sustainable. And
is it if you go away from Thought Bubble going, I've not sold very many at all, and you're there feeling a bit pathetic because you're desperate. I don't know if this is typical of everyone's feelings about it, but I'm talking, maybe I'm talking too personally and I should be more discreet. But because I think Thought Bubble is a great event.
Yeah.
I'm just talking in more general terms about...
Yeah. So you're saying it's like Thought Bubble is a bit different to everything else. It is bigger. It's sort of the exception to the rule, maybe, then.
Yeah. I mean, in the main, comic conventions operate on that model. If you want to exhibit, you pay for a table, and you are usually one of a number of small pressers who are having to sell your stuff.
Mm.
It's the caption model. You would go in with your comics, and you'd hand them over.
Yeah.
And they would sell them on your behalf.
Yeah.
And then you're free to go and enjoy the event.
Yeah. I loved that. That was brilliant. Yeah.
And I wonder if that's a model that needs to be kind of looked at again, maybe.
I do like it.
I think you have to or Thought Bubble, but I mean collectively.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room for that. I think it's something that could be looked at, definitely. Basically, it's saying to the convention, get more involved in that side of things. You know, help the creators sell their stuff, give them a platform, you know, and in return, you know, maybe the creators, okay, they're not paying for a table, but they'll just pay a ticket to come in or something like that.
But the caption would take a percentage of what they
sell. They take a percentage, yeah. And it used to work for me. I used to put stuff on the caption table because the first time I went to caption, I asked them for a table and they said, well, we don't really do that. We just have the caption table. And I said, well, let me have a go. And I remember the first caption I ever did.
Yes, that's the first time I met you.
Yeah, and I made a lot of money at caption.
And you were upstairs in a kind of a sort of cubby hole.
Yeah,
and
well
I
out of the way.
And there by accident. And then you were, I went, all right, mate. Put webs on you.
Yeah. Sitting there in a sleeveless t-shirt. I remember it well. But I remember I made about £1,000 that day.
Did you? That's very nice.
Yeah. Because every single person there was interested in what I was selling. So there's only like, I don't know, 120 people that captioned that year. Every single one of them wanted to buy my stuff.
Yeah. And it's the audience, isn't it? If you find your audience, boom.
Yeah, find that audience. And, I think there is definitely a model.
Pete Ashton used to do a bug powder table, didn't he, I think?
Yeah.
Maybe after you.
Mm, yeah, he's been...
And I think he always seemed to have a big crowd around him.
Yeah, I mean, it was cool as well. I mean, the way... Pete was really good at making small press cool, you know?
Yeah.
I remember buying his bug powder sheets, you know, I think they were like 10p or whatever, you know, and they were just review sheets, weren't they? But I remember reading reading these reviews and thinking, this is cool. You know, this is edgy. This is something a little bit countercultury.
Yeah.
That sort of thing doesn't really exist anymore, does it?
Well, I think we've got Broken Frontier. That's sort of the,
yes,
I guess, the closest we've got to that. But I think we're at a point in comics where, when bug powder existed, there was a strong comics infrastructure. So you can have this sort of alternative to it because it's
strong in the mainstream. Yeah.
We don't have that now.
I think that's a really good point. I think a lot of people say it, don't they? You know, if DC and Marvel aren't doing well, everyone else suffers because the infrastructure of the industry isn't there. Then that means...
I don't think we're going to see Marvel and DC improve because they're, you know, they're now obsessed with the IPs, you know. And, and it seems to me that there are other publishers as well that take that approach.
Yeah.
I'll ask you a question. I've not really asked this of any, but I don't really talk to very few comic people. Are you as baffled by the continued presence of Vampirella as I am? Where the fuck is that comic still being published?
I mean,
even in 1985, I'm going, what the fuck is this?
I would have to ask David Roach that question. Because he's a massive Vampirella fan. He knows everything about Vampirella. And I'm talking to Dan Abnett soon about, he's working on it.
I'm now causing, I've set a bomb off amongst
I mean, but I get what you're saying, because the character is a bit dated. And where does the, I used to think.
What is the character? She's just a woman who's a vampire that doesn't wear very many clothes.
Let's face it, she doesn't wear many clothes. I think that's the thing.
She wears a mankini.
Yeah. But she looks better in it than we would. That's the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that's a good, serious question, that is. But yeah, no, there's a few characters like that. I used to wonder what the attraction of She was, you know, S-H-I.
That's not really a comic I'd ever engage with.
I never got that. No disrespect to any of the creators, you know. Just personally, myself, I just never got the appeal of that thing. But I sort of get Vampirella. I think, you know, some of the artwork is pretty impressive. I think it's very visual-led, you know, not just because it's, you know, titillation. Or
whatever. I'm not talking about the quality of the artwork.
Yeah, yeah.
Or even the writing, although I'll probably imply, it's implied, isn't it?
Well, sort of. If you say the art's good, right?
I don't know the writing because I don't read it.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's the best writing you've ever read, mate.
Is it a satire?
I think there is a tongue-in-cheek satirical edge to Vampirella, yeah. I think it knows what it is. I mean, I've only read bits.
Does that legitimise it?
Yeah, sort of. Because it sort of knows what it is and what it, you know, and what its fan base is, I think. And so I think you can play with the character, can't you? I mean, actually, I was talking to Dan Abnett about it, and his approach was sort of like, yeah, I know what this character is, and we're going to have some fun with it. Because they're going to be putting her in sort of like a superhero team, which she doesn't belong in at all.
Right.
And I think, yeah, that's going to be fun, you know, because they're playing with what the character is.
I would love to do Vampirella just walking around and living a normal life.
Going down the supermarket.
And kind of people tutting and rolling their eyes.
With her rollers in. She could have her rollers in, couldn't she?
No, someone having to go at her for not wearing a mask.
Yeah. I'm immortal, don't you know?
No matter how much she's revealing, it's the mask that's the issue.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
brilliant.
I'm all right with Vampirella now. I'm okay.
You've worked it out. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that, you know, whatever else has happened this evening, you know, we've got to that point. Where Vampirella
makes
sense.
Going back to conventions, I'm not having a go at hard work or I'm more talking about, is it really achieving what we would like it to achieve for comics?
Yeah.
There's so many great comic creators who self-produce because there isn't an infrastructure, that industry, and there should be.
Yeah.
And these methods of presenting ourselves aren't really working for the majority of us.
Mm, mm.
And so therefore it needs maybe a different approach. Kickstarter seems a good way. I've seen there's some anthologies on there that are...
Yeah, it works for a lot of people, Kickstarter.
Yeah.
But it is limited.
I mean, I did it for the first time recently and it was a joy.
How did you... Was that sarcasm then? For
no, no, honestly, all right. It was
weird. Wait,
I couldn't believe it.
So you got you had a successful campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I was resistant because it felt a bit like begging.
Yeah.
I mean, my attitude is I'm going to have the work done already. Mm. I'm going to do it anyway.
I think that's the best way anyway. I think that's the best way of doing it, to be honest.
I don't think you should go in with, I've got an idea for a project.
No.
Fund me before I start working on it.
Yeah, you should have at least have the script written and, at least to the point where you can say, oh, okay, it's not finished, but it's going to be finished in X amount of weeks. Have just an idea and maybe a cover.
I think you should be finished. I think you should be determined to do it anyway.
Yeah.
But Kickstarter's an opportunity. But I was very pleased.
What book was that on, Paul?
Journey into Indignity, which came out, got back from the printers yesterday. So it's a collection of comics I've done over the last year or two, and it includes three previous entries into the short story prize that didn't. Filed.
Trying to think of a better word. So are these previously unpublished then? No one's seen them before?
Some of them I've shared online.
Yeah, but not in print.
No.
Well, that's cool. And did you find that with Kickstarter, because a lot of people have said to me that it's not just a way of selling your books, it's also a way of expanding your audience because it does help you reach out to where did your fans, for want of a better word, who were pledged on the book, where did they come from? Were they mostly Brits or did you get a lot of stuff from overseas as well?
Some overseas. They seem to be mainly Brits, I would say. I'd say maybe 20% were overseas.
All right.
But that's a big percentage, I feel. But
It is.
What I found interesting was it was split into thirds. It seemed to be thirds of people from comics I knew, third from people I knew who wanted
just
to support,
wanted to support
me.
Yeah.
And I mean, some of these people were people I hadn't seen for 10 years or longer even, but they wanted to support me. And then a third seemed to be people I'd never heard of before.
Yeah, well, that's good, because that's a third of it is new readers, isn't it? Then you can build on that.
That's brilliant. And I hear that about Kickstarter. I hear that when you do another one, then...
They come back.
Yeah. But what I found interesting was that people would... The pledge would be, say, £8 for a comic, including postage, and they'd go, "Oh, pledge 10."
Yeah.
Why? I mean, I'm so touched by that sort of gesture.
Yeah, but people will do that. That's what I'm, on Kickstarter, they say they tend to do that because some people, when they do a Kickstarter, they put, just pledge without anything. They just give me some money. And people do that. They just give them money because they want to support what they're doing. I mean, I personally feel like that is begging. I couldn't do that. I'd have to give them something, even if it was just like a PDF for £2.
No, I want to offer something.
Yeah, I think it has to be some sort of exchange. And I do feel that it needs to be good value for money. Some of these campaigns,
Well, I feel that way about my comics I sell anyway. I want people to feel that they've not bought something that isn't worth the money they've spent. And sometimes that's not always easy because printing
it's expensive
costs and so forth. But I really want them to feel that they've not wasted their money, that it's not filler. Do you know what I mean? That it's all got content. Well, at least that's what I aim for.
Oh, go on, say it. It's all killer, not filler.
It's all driller.
I mean, I'll be totally honest, mate. Every book I've ever read of yours, every strip I've ever read, I've thoroughly enjoyed. And I do think it has mass appeal, because a lot of it is really, it's just really well-observed stuff. Especially the humour element. They just make you laugh. And I think a lot of comics, they are trapped in genre traps, aren't they? It's like, oh, these comics appeal to this crowd. These comics appeal to this crowd. I do feel that your comics can appeal to anybody, who's willing to pick them up and read them.
In the interview I did for The Observer, I don't know if I told you I won the Graphic Short Story Prize.
Oh, is that so?
And I started rattling on about how I was thinking more culturally, but British stuff has a bit of a tendency in recent times to feel like it's transatlantic. Do you know what I mean? That they're not really about, even Coronation Street has a sort of a cycle of having a serial killer in it. I can't watch it anymore.
Yeah. And Doctor Who's changed its music. To me, that was a real like transatlantic thing. And I know why they did it, and I understand it, but it didn't feel so British anymore.
No, and there's something, a loss to that. It doesn't mean that things can't change, but that transatlantic feel is always, I feel, disappointing. Mm. And I was trying to say that I think if I like to do British stuff, doesn't mean I'm trying to exclude Americans from reading it. No. I just... You know, they're welcome, but I'm not really thinking about you when I write and draw it. I'm thinking about a bloke down the street. Yeah. You used to have, like, you'd be able to go into newsagents and buy comics quite easily in the 70s. They were quite commonplace.
Yeah, I miss those times.
Well, people do get them. They do enjoy them. There's just a woolly cloud between those of us that make them.
Yeah,
and those people that might enjoy them.
That's the bottom line, isn't it? That, like a woolly cloud. I like that.
Well, yeah, we just don't know how to get across that expanse.
Yeah, from the creator to the reader. It is hard, isn't it? Especially your audience that will love your stuff. And obviously there are professional ways of doing it. And I was taking part in Hannah Berry's discussion. I don't know if you were taking part.
No.
It was really good discussion, but it did go around in circles a little bit because there's a lot of people in the discussion. Yeah. So it's hard, isn't it, to make progress sometimes when there's that many people involved. But when they were talking, I was thinking to myself, well, the mechanism is there. You know, if you look at other industries and how they promote themselves, creative industries, like the music industry, for example, it's all there. The marketing is there. But us creators... We don't always have those skills.
We're not always, yeah, exactly. We're not really very good at it. What I tried decided to do a couple of years ago when I got pissed off with events, is I went, okay, what I'm going to try and do is find ways of selling my stuff, bypassing it. So for example, I got asked to do a local authors event at Luton Library. And to me, that was great. It was a short drive. £5 parking. It was only 4 hours on a Saturday, and I took like 80 quid.
It's all right.
That's great. And that's and that's better than often conventions where it's a long drive, it's a long day.
Yeah, and you've got to expenses. Pay as well. That's the thing, isn't it? That's...
Yeah. I did. So I've been more interested in doing, well, not interested, but I was curious to see if I could make those smaller events work. And I've done a couple of more localised, alternative type events, and I've found them enjoyable.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I did a mural when the opportunity came along to do that in Central. I've done two, actually.
Oh.
And that was a good opportunity because it's a good outreach, I think. Because... You know, ignoring COVID, it could have had 1 million people a year walk past.
Yeah, well, it will do at some point, you know.
Yeah.
Once COVID's over with.
I did an adaptation of a local musical about a guy who lived in the local area who went on to design David Bowie's Starman outfit and persona.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is a good opportunity to make a comic that will be seen by people that don't always read comics. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because you've got a whole different fan base there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've always typically, I think that's what we should be doing rather than thinking, I don't really think that people think this, but thinking I need to make my own version of the thing from the Fantastic Four. I don't know how people, but thinking of their audience as being the same as Marvel and DC.
No, I think you're dead right. Yeah, I think it's finding your own audience, isn't it? Not trying to latch on to an existing audience. It's finding that unique audience that's yours, that's going to stay loyal to you, that's going to buy your stuff. And it works in other creative industries. Though. Yeah, well,
I wouldn't even say I've got an audience, but it's taken me a long time to realise that at least this is worth looking at.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good positive note to end on, mate. Oh. Because we have chatted.
Just started. After dissing all comic conventions.
Well, you know. I mean, we always have good, honest conversations, don't we, mate?
And I feel like I've. I was merely pointing out that it's not proven to bolster the comic industry.
Yeah, I think the model of conventions does have to change. I think that,
yes.
I mean, and yeah. You know, I think a lot of us...
Thank you for understanding.
No. And I think a lot of us who do conventions know that, and we're looking at ways of doing it. And I think we will see changes once COVID's over and conventions come back. I think we will see a lot of changes in how conventions, especially the smaller ones, are actually put together. Yeah. I think they have to change because they don't work for everybody at the moment, they are. And yeah, I think you're right. So thanks for that.
We've both left slightly diminished and sad.
No, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. I mean, as always, you know, it's always like we could chat for ages. You know, at conventions, we always
nap. It's shot by.
It really does. Yeah. I mean, it's been well over an hour, but it's been really good to
nice,
chat with you.
Well, it's nice to talk about comics as well. And it's nice to have a chat with you, Shane, because I see you like once every couple of years, really, don't I?
I know. And even less.
One of us is normally quite busy.
Yeah, I'm usually whizzing by, aren't I? Yeah. The only chance we have a proper chat is
in the bar. Well, you're normally kind of going, I don't want to be away from the table for too long.
Yeah.
You know, or someone might want to buy something.
Yeah, definitely. And I totally understand that one. So again, mate, congratulations on the prize.
Thank you very much.
You know, fantastic. Well deserved. And hopefully we'll see each other again soon in the flesh. And
can I tell your listeners that they can buy my comics from my website?
Oh, I forgot all about that bit. Yes.
Now I
please
feel like
do.
The right Huxley. Right, no,
please go. You commercial whore, you.
So I bought two new comics out this year, Starman and Journey into Indignity. Yeah. And you can buy those from pbrainey.com.
Excellent. And
all my other stuff.
Yeah, all this other stuff. And please do, guys, you know, go on there, buy Paul's stuff because it's absolutely brilliant. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I've loved his work for many years now. You seriously have to go and check it out. It's not just the observer that think it's good.
I won't mention this. I was about to say something, but I stopped myself.
Stop yourself.
Yeah.
All right, then, mate. I'm going to go. You have a great
Shane.
Evening.
Take
All the
care.
Best.
Look after yourself.
And you, buddy. Bye. Bye-bye.